Yeah, I'm so glad that Dr. Ralph Sterling could join us this evening. I send out my email messages across Illinois, Wisconsin, Michigan, and a little bit even further. And so it's a long ways from Grand Rapids to come to a meeting like this. And Ralph often says, oh, I wish I could come. I'm glad you could come this time. As professor of geology at Calvin College, he teaches courses in paleontology, earth history, and sedimentary geology. And his education includes degrees from the universities of Missouri, Utah, and Michigan. Ralph is active in communicating the findings of geology and paleontology to the church, including a presentation that was given last year to the Evangelical Theological Society. So you can find a video of that as well. He and Calvin colleague Davis Young co-wrote The Bible Rocks and Time, Geological Evidence for the Age of the Earth, which is so good, Wheaton College geology majors are required to read it in their earth history class. And Ralph is the first natural scientist to be awarded the Henry Resident Fellowship at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School this year with his project, Assessing Evidences for Cognitive Abilities in Ancient Hominins with Reference to Their Perception of God. But tonight, he'll bring us more to his roots in paleontology in his lecture, A Midwestern Paleontological Perspective on the Biostratigraphic Record and a Protracted History of Life. Join me in welcoming Dr. Ralph Sterling.
It's been really fun to get to know Wheaton colleagues over many, many years. In the mid-1990s, I taught three summers at Wheaton's Science Station along with colleagues here and got to know the geologists very well. That's where I met Ray, actually, was, I think,
at the,
it was a one. It was 96 or something like that, something. Maybe it was a little later.
A little later, but yeah.
I think I can remember the occasion, but I remember meeting you on the campus there. So it's been a lot of fun. And I'm not sure exactly where to kick start this. There, Ray mentioned that there is a short version of this. So Stephen Mosier from Wheaton and I were asked to give talks as part of a give and take session at the Evangelical Theological Society. And if you can find that online, the BioLogos people have put that up. That's a 37-minute talk. This is twice as long. So I'm sort of promising you tonight a 70, 75-minute talk. That's done, I want to assure you, out of respect for you guys, in that you kind of deserve something that's got some meat in it and not quick, short, summary, soundbite sort of approach. It's done out of a sense of respect for the subject matter. We are, after all, talking about an Earth that's millions of years old, and there's a lot of data in millions of years. And it's unfortunately easy that some Christians can toss off some of that data in very, very quick little sound bites that make it sound like it all happened overnight when it could not possibly have. And the third reason is out of respect for God, the fact that His creation is a wonderful place. He's designed it for us to inhabit, and we deserve to give Him a little bit of His due. So that's I'm hoping that you're willing to bear with me for 70 minutes or so, and that it will prove useful to people. While I'm going to skip over a few of the early slides, which I used at a student group this afternoon, but how many here know what a Petoskey stone is? Let me ask you that. That's more than this afternoon. So I hold an exemplar Petoskey stone. This is a polished one that a colleague of mine at Calvin, actually an English prof named Jim Vandenbosch, Jim has turned to doing lapidary work in his retirement. He gave me this as a gift. I've got tons more at Calvin, but in Michigan, we think we own these fossils, as though they never occur anywhere else in the world. So we've named them after a town in Michigan. Michigan has two state stones, and it's because we have the Upper Peninsula and the Lower Peninsula, and you've got to satisfy both. We have the Greenstone, which is the state stone for the Upper Peninsula, and this is the state stone for the Lower Peninsula. We also have a state fossil. That's the mastodon, so that's different, although this is also a fossil. So we will pass this around momentarily. This is a fossil coral. It's from the upper middle Devonian, so it's roughly about 380 to 385 million years old by standard geological reckoning. We'll talk more about, you'll see a lot of instances of this and some of its kindred kinds. But this way, this will kickstart the conversation. And if I can trouble you guys to pass it around, please don't pocket it. It's precious to me. So we'll start this around. The site that you see in front of you is a site that I've been to many times. Is it possible maybe to turn the
yes.
lights off in the front bank? Because
Ben, could you just
it'll be more photogenic, more beautiful if we can turn off a few of the lights. Thanks. That works for me if it works for everyone here. This is a site I've been to many times. I started going here in 1990 before I had finished my PhD at the University of Michigan with students in tow. And I've been there so many times I've lost track. At least 18, maybe 20, maybe 24, but I don't know. And I've always had groups with me, groups of students, families with kids, guest faculty, all kinds of other people. And it's visited by multiple hundreds of other people from the general public every year. The quarry managers do a great job at public outreach. This sits on the shore of Lake Huron, on the northeastern shore of the lower peninsula of Lake Michigan at the town of Alpena. Just some thanks to a lot of different people, and these thanks have to extend to you guys here for hosting me tonight. So this is the punchline. This is where I'm trying to go. We'll see whether I succeed or not. And that is that there is abundant fossil evidence. By abundant, I mean millions of fossils lying around ready for people to pull them out of the ground in many, many different layers of rock. We're gradually penetrating those layers and bringing these things to the surface. And not only are they abundant in the ground, but they are abundant in the sense that any people here in this room could go and see for yourself. That's why I'm emphasizing the Midwest in this talk. The only reason for emphasizing the Midwest is the fact that these are sites that are accessible to anybody in this room if you want to get in your car and drive a little bit. Sometimes you have to go at the right time of the year so that the sites are not underwater or buried by snow, but otherwise these are accessible. And so they're available to amateurs. They're available to middle school kids. These are things that are not hidden for rocket scientists. Okay? And the punchline then is, if indeed we have this long protracted period of life on Earth, then God, what is it telling us about God? I think it's telling us that God is a very patient creator and a very prolific creator. We want to talk a little bit on the way about the notion that any of these fossils represent things that died in the past. And to some people's minds, notably a number of prominent atheists, that indicates to them that God is somehow or another wasteful or indifferent. He doesn't care whether things live or die. Well, I think these things testify to a different kind of creator. So let's come back to that. And along the way, I'll engage in some polemics against some fellow Christians that think that the earth is only a few thousands of years old, and that all the fossils that you're looking at that are in these rocks here and others were entombed in a single year-long flood. And so some of my talk will be polemical, but that's not really the goal. Here's my real goals for the talk, and you can kind of grill me at the end and see whether I accomplished them. I really want to overemphasize the fact that we want to enjoy God's good creation. It's a good creation, and we don't honor God if we don't enjoy it. On the other hand, if we want to really enjoy it, we have to take it seriously. We have to take it on God's terms and not try to twist it or ignore things it's telling us. As I've mentioned before, I want to talk about fossils and present data that's readily accessible to anyone in this room or anyone around campus or in Chicago, and then enjoy talking with you, Lord willing. And I prepared a small prologue to talk to students today at Wheaton College, and so Some of you may know who Russell Mixter is. I'm going to actually skip over these slides in order to keep this to a reasonable length. I talked to students this afternoon, including the great-grandson of Alton Everest, who's here at Wheaton now as a student. At any rate, you guys know who Morrison Whitcomb are. And some of you know who my colleague Dave Young is. Dave was an inspiration to many young Christian geologists in the 1980s and beyond. Eventually, he became my colleague at Calvin. He wrote this book in 1982. It's pretty much out of print, 170 pages long. And then in 2008, Dave and I published this update. So Ray mentioned this particular book here. This is published by InterVarsity Press. It's 500 pages long. It's not a slouch read. They've kept it in print up until this date, and it's now published in Korean. So it's proving to have some use. Incidentally, in this initial cover, this was an initial draft of the cover by InterVarsity Press. They misspelled my last name, so that's, they're not infallible. So we'll start here. Here are, the next slide will illustrate some claims that I have heard, and no doubt all of you have heard at some time or another, put forth by people who believe the Earth is only a few thousands of years, about geologists, right, and paleontologists. For one, the past is non-repeatable. It's already happened, it's been and gone. So it cannot be studied on a lab bench. You can't grab the past and put it on a lab bench and put a microscope on it or whatnot. I'll dispute this later on, you'll see why. And hence, it is not a part of science, okay? Secondly, geologists lie about the stratigraphic record, or at least indulge in circular reasoning. If, in theory, if they indulge in circular reasoning intentionally, that's as good as lying. Thirdly, geology students are indoctrinated in college. They don't really learn anything about nature. They're told what they're supposed to believe, and they blithely just soak it all in, and then they're indoctrinated. I told that to the students this afternoon, and I don't think they would have agreed with that. You know, they get out on field trips and actually see what rocks are all about. And then lastly, a common claim that many of you probably have heard before and do not need to be reminded. Christian scientists who believe that the Earth is indeed an object of great antiquity, or take your pick, could be the cosmos is an object of great antiquity, or life has a long history, they are called compromisers. And this has been the word, the epithet of choice for decades, probably going back to George McCready Price and before, that if you don't buy into their program of accepting that the Earth is a few thousands of years old and life has an accordingly small history, then you're somehow or another a compromiser. I'll address this claim, number two here, that geologists indulge in circular reasoning. I'll come back to this diagram again later on in the talk. These are three diagrams that I pulled off the web a year ago, and I could have pulled off 100 more. I'll address this one in particular near the end of the talk, that they purport to show how these lying geologists indulge in circular reasoning. They have a preconception about where the history of life should be going because they bought into Darwinian evolution. And because they have this preconception, when it comes to actually ordering the fossil record, they simply go back in and they manipulate the data which are within the rocks to tell their version of the story. And that's blatantly not right, but that's the message that's out there. And so we want to address this particular claim near the end of my talk. What I want to do is show you differently. Right. So I start off with a mascot of sorts. This is a slab I collected in central Missouri around 1979 or 1980, so close to 40 years ago, if not 40 years ago. And the slab sits on my office desk today. I love this rock. And I think it's very beautiful. It's very aesthetic. I told the students today, I have dreams sometimes about this particular coral. In one version, it's the coral's like this, and these little individuals there are as big as pie plates. It's just amazing. So this is the genus Hexagonaria. It's named because of the hexagonal shapes to the coral colonies. It's a colonial coral, and anatomically, it's clustered into the order Rugosa, which is an extinct order. There are no Rugosan corals alive today on the planet. And that's an important point, and that's a launch pad. So the coral that were passed around, and which we now look at in this slab that I collected 40 years ago, are important pegs or hooks to hang this talk from. Just to remind you, what does an order mean? Well, in the Linnaean, this is Carolus Linnaeus, a Christian biologist credited with giving us the sort of standard taxonomic scheme. Within an order, you have families. Within family, you have genera. Within a genus, you have species. If you were looking at mammals, an order would be carnivora. The families subsumed under that would be things like Felidae, the cats, Canidae, the dogs and wolves, Mustelidae, which would be the weasels and minks and otters and things, and several other families. And within each of those families, there are many, many genera. And within each genus, there are many, many species. So in other words, if we want to extinct this coral, going back for a minute, we not only have to extinct this order, we have to extinct all of the families within that, all of the genera within each family, and all of the species within each genus. That's a lot of extinction. So that's a lot of individual kinds of creatures that have gone extinct in order for this taxonomic unit to be completely vanished from the record. And we're going to see cases of many, many other extinct orders today. So I'll begin the tale with looking at Devonian biotas in the mid-continent region. Most of the talk will stress the mid-continent. Near the end of the talk, I'll divert over to the Grand Canyon for a little bit. But this is this quarry, it's within the city limits of Alpena, Michigan, which is on a bay called Thunder Bay. There's also a Thunder Bay, Ontario. Don't confuse them. But it's on Thunder Bay on Lake Huron. This is a quarry that's been mined for over 100 years, first by the Portland Cement Company, now by the Lafarge Corporation. In a good economic year, they'll turn out 2.7 million tons of cement out of this plant. This is a very active quarry, and at the same time, they do the public a great service by permitting lots and lots of groups to come in on the weekends and look at their work and their products and stuff, and collect fossils. My students at Calvin and I have collected thousands of fossils, individual fossils from this particular quarry, and we're only the tip of the iceberg because there are dozens of other groups going every warm 6 months of the year. Lots and lots of school kids, middle school groups, rock hound groups, college students have been to this particular quarry and collected fossils. To set the stage, I have to let you know a little bit about the rock record of Michigan and, for that matter, Illinois, Indiana, Ontario, Ohio. The layers of rock here in the Midwest are, by and large, very, very flat line. Geologists jokingly call it a layer cake. You envision it as a series of layers, and when we drill it for water or for oil, we puncture these layers, and we have a really good understanding built up for many thousands of drill holes about the rocks under our feet. It's counterintuitive, but a good oil geologist in the Midwest knows the rock layers like the back of his or her hand. The rock layers, moreover, are very, very gently warped. This exaggerates the sense of warping that we see here. So you have to imagine these layers as almost exactly flat, but nonetheless gently warped. That means over lateral distances of hundreds of miles, these rocks are brought to the surface at different spots, and then erosion has exposed them. They're also covered by dirt and so forth, but where they're visible, erosion has exposed them, so that if I, as a Midwestern geologist, or any of you here, want to examine different layers of rock, instead of drilling down, all you have to do is go laterally across the surface of the earth. So in this case, the bowing of the earth has brought up some of the lower layers up to the surface in the center. This is called a dome, also an anticline. And so if you want to find younger layers, you progressively drive or walk out this direction. And in this case, the bowing downwards has brought the older layers up out on the periphery. So if I want to see older layers, I go out to the outside and younger layers to the inside. In this case, because we're starting in the Devonian in Michigan, we're starting somewhere in the middle. I'll go up and down by simply moving laterally across the surface of the earth. Does that make sense geometrically?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a great gift to us from God. Okay. In Michigan, yeah.
How do you know the center?
Here's the answer. You wouldn't expect it, right? But Michigan was the 16th largest, the 16th greatest oil and gas producing state in the Union. We have a lot of oil and gas in various layers down there, and that's been the impetus for all of this drilling. And that's almost all of those have been in the Lower Peninsula. So the Lower Peninsula, you see this bullseye pattern, that corresponds to a set of nested saucers with the topmost saucer here in the center, and et cetera, proceeding outwards. And I don't think we know the exact center, but in fact, it's an odd shaped thing. It's not quite like your set of nested mixing bowls at home, but it's kind of blobby, right? But the deepest exploratory drill was the Sparks drill, drilled about in here, and that went down 17,000 feet and bottomed out in Precambrian bedrock, which was igneous volcanic rock, so below the stack of sedimentary layers. So the way the structure runs, it's about 3 miles, this is about 3 miles thick of rock here, sedimentary rock, and about 2 miles deep on the periphery. This structure has been squashed because we've got 3 miles here and 200 miles here, and it's done in the interest of putting it in one graphic so that everyone can, so you can see it on one page, right? So it's the vertical relief here is greatly distorted. That means, in my case, if I want to see, this is where we just saw that quarry, up in this part of Michigan where the rocks are marked D for Devonian, I can track that all the way around the upper part of the Lower Peninsula and over into Ontario, and then it circles back around. I can hit it again in southeastern Michigan, northern Ohio, and back up over here in Iowa. And there was an outcrop down there in southern and central Missouri, and there are more down here in southern Indiana. So because these structures do this kind of stuff. Yes, ma'am.
I'm just a little bit curious. The basin shape that these rocks form, it seems fairly simple and straightforward.
It is simple, and it is straightforward.
Yeah, the pressure makes them bow down, but what exactly makes them bow up out of the earth?
That's a terrific question. It turns out that by analyzing, so let's suppose the layer was distorted after it hardened. The thickness would be more or less consistent across the band of the layer. But let's suppose it was being distorted as it was forming. You'd expect it to thicken up near the bottom or thin out on the limbs. Take your pick. By doing that, we can actually time when the distortion was happening. And it turns out that the distortion episodes are exactly coincident with the pulses of mountain building on the eastern coast of North America that raise the Appalachian Mountains. So the compressional forces like this that actually squashed the rocks in the vicinity of Tennessee and Virginia and down into Alabama, you know, and then on up into New York State and Pennsylvania, those are obviously what you call compressive forces, And those compressive forces didn't just stop at the Appalachian. They rippled out in a more distant and gentle way. And then the ripples kind of vanish. They gradually dampen out. So these are ripples. These are long distance ripples that are relics of the Appalachian. There are multiple pulses of mountain building when the Appalachians were raised. And these are actually the episodes of warping or timed in accord with that.
And so that warping explains why it is
kind
of the shape of
a. In Michigan, there's one more factor, and that is that 1.1 billion years ago, we had a huge outpouring of basalt that floors the Lake Superior region. It goes all the way down into Kansas. It tracks like a horseshoe into the Lower Peninsula. So underneath here in the bottom, we've got a huge slug of very, very dense rock. So that's acting like an anchor. And if this is, imagine this is like Play-Doh kinds of stuff, and you're rippling it, and you've got something heavy down here that's going to tug downwards. So that's, in our individual case, that's almost certainly why it warped down rather than warping up. And I'd be happy to talk with you more about that later. It's a great detective story. Yeah. So, but the punchline for our analysis is that by going laterally across the surface of the Earth, I can actually step on the edges of different layers, almost like the edges of a set of nested saucers. So, we're back to this quarry. There's the star indicating the location. I'll show you this map in a few more minutes with multiple more stars. We'll broaden this out. But in this case, in this quarry and in immediately surrounding areas in Alpena, I started collecting there in 1990 with students from the University of Michigan, and then have kept up the tradition at Calvin College up until today, and I'll probably take a group up this coming fall in 2018. I want to come back to that idea in a minute. At this point, I have to jump to what I'm going to do is minimize this and minimize that and go to this. So how many here know the organization Answers in Genesis? Okay, this is a one-page blog on Alpena, Michigan, the very same site that I've been talking about. And it's by an Answers in Genesis geologist from 1998, right? And so in my personal experience, right, I've been to this location many, many times, and we will look at what the narrator says. And the important point is, what does the narrator leave out? Okay, so everything you're going to see on this page is accurate. It's just that what's not being told is 80% of the story. Okay, so here is a nice picture of the coastline there, and a general introduction to the area. At Partridge Point, that's a peninsula on the south side of town, are outcrops of a fossil graveyard, one of many fossil deposits found around the world that are significant as examples of the catastrophism during the flood. So we want to analyze that claim and see what is the author not telling us. That's the big thing here, right? So here's a description of the locality. The outcrops of interest belong to the Thunder Bay Limestone. The Thunder Bay Limestone is a geologic formation. It's maybe about 100 feet thick. It's part of a larger cluster of formations that are collectively called the Traverse Group. The stuff we were looking at in the quarry are also from the Traverse Group, but they lie a little bit lower in the sequence than this particular unit. I've collected, actually, with students from this very same locality that this author has describing, and we'll look at that in a minute. Okay. So here's the location, and there we see in this map, the red dot would be where the quarry was that we were just looking at, and then this is a peninsula on the south side of the bay. There. Okay, the sequence of rock types. Can everyone see this, I hope? In the outcrops, making up the Thunder Bay limestone is shown diagrammatically in figure four. There's a diagram coming up. Of particular interest are the light-colored shaley beds and limestone full of fossilized corals and shellfish. The remains include the skeletons of animals that once lived attached to the rocky bottom of a shallow sea, such as colonial corals, bunches of corals connected to one another like apartments, solitary corals, bryozoans, lace corals, crinoids, sea lilies, stromatoporoids, extinct sea creatures of uncertain identification, possibly related to sponges and corals. They are an extinct group of sponge, that's true. Brachiopods, lamp shells, similar to clams, but with a foot for attaching themselves permanently to sea bottom, and blastoids, relatives of the crinoids and the sea urchins. Of course, blastoids are totally extinct, and that's one element that I want to talk about. There are also the fossilized remains of more mobile sea creatures, such as crocodiles, once again, extinct animals, whose only remains are tiny like jaw-like bones with serrations like teeth. A detailed description of these rocks with a complete list of their fossils has been compiled. Well, it was compiled by two paleontologists for a field guide, and they worked for the University of Michigan Museum of Paleontology, where I did my PhD. So I own a copy of that field guide, and I was able to go back and actually extract the data here, and I'll compare that in a minute. Okay. We go on, there's his diagram of the layers. And he's talking about fossil crinoids. The crinoid stems are stalks which were once connected and stacked on top of one another. After death, crinoids fell apart very quickly. So it was common to find abundant fossilized columnals from broken stalks scattered and jumbled indiscriminately throughout limestones such as this. So these fossils have been scattered indiscriminately. Thrown together are pieces of the corals and so forth, the solitary coral. And then he goes on to say, the limestone that now entombs these remains cannot be where these creatures once lived because they are not found here in their living positions. The solitary coral, for example, is not seen here attached to the sea bottom with a distinct hard surface visible in the rock mass, but was completely enclosed in what originally was soft lime mud, which only became rock hard after burying the coral. So the claim is being made here that these fossils have been jumbled about, tossed about, strewn who knows how long, and whither and where, and then kind of dumped en masse in a mass of soft, limey mud, right? Now, right off the bat, people that have looked at the picture up there would have seen that those fossils are not abraded. They're not degraded, they're pristine. They're beautiful little biological skeletons. And if they had been tossed about over long distances, you would expect them to be just totally, not only smashed, but scratched. These are soft skeletons, okay? We'll look at some in a minute. So, here we go. There is therefore only one conclusion, which makes sense of the evidence. These sea creatures were buried together suddenly when overwhelmed, carried, and then dumped by moving water filled with lime muds. That is why geologists call this a fossil graveyard. I don't call it a fossil graveyard myself. This is a term that has been employed by young earth geologists for decades to kind of give the impression that it's a sudden catastrophic kind of a thing. These graveyards are all jumbled, tossed together, and buried haphazardly in sediments laid down by moving water. So we want to actually look at this haphazard nature. Is it really that haphazard? Or is there a logic going on here? So I have extracted some of this text, and I'm going to X out of that and go back to this. Okay, so we just went to... Any of you can look this up online if you choose by going to Answers in Genesis and then Thundering Burial. This is a pun because it's at Thunder Bay. And it's a graveyard, right? It's a fossil graveyard. Okay. This is an example of coral that we pulled up commonly near Alpena. This is cylinder phylum. This block right here is exactly 1 centimeter on the side, so that's a cubic centimeter. It gives you an example of whether you think this thing was tossed about for very, and carried very far distances, and rolled and smashed, okay? It's in pretty good shape. But even more to the point, this is the same kind of coral, cylinder phylum. Let me broaden that out, okay? Same block, and what you're seeing here are numerous tubes like that there. This is a large colony. This is a slab that's about 1.5 feet across. It's on display at the college. We collected it many years ago, somewhere around 2000. This is a look up close. You can see all these individual animals. The technical term is corallite. So this is an individual animal living in that tube. That's a corallite. If you were to count, you'd find many dozens of them exposed here on the surface of the slab. The next picture takes us, it flips the slab over, and we see what's on the bottom. This is very typical for coral growth. You see radiating outward. Corals reproduce sexually and asexually by budding. The standard method is by budding. So one individual lands here, buds out and buds out and buds out, and the colony radiates out. So we picked this slab up where it was lying on the beach, and I didn't think to think, oh, is it attached to the seafloor here, or was it? But you can see that this is preserved in pretty good shape. It's never been moved very far from where it started its life. It's been compressed a little bit and shattered over geologic time. These things have not moved much relative to one another. So, yes, indeed, coral reefs are subject to stresses. They're subject to surf. They're subject to hurricanes and other phenomenal storms. So, no surprise that we find elements that are knocked over, carried around, and rolled in the surf. But when you find preservation like this, one says to oneself, these things never moved very far, and they never suffered much in the way of post-mortem damage. Okay, so you have to think, now does that jive with his view of planetary-wide catastrophe with waves sweeping around the planet at rapid speeds, and perhaps tidal waves 1,000 feet high, what they've called a mega tsunami? Maybe I don't see that, but at any rate, that's something to think about. But there's more. Yet there's more to think about in terms of that article. So here's his list of creatures that we already read. This may resonate with what we've already read. It's, once again, you can check me on this. And what I've done is gone back to the original literature and extracted all the taxonomic terms, which was easy to do because they're in appendices at the end. And I'll give you that in a minute. Okay. So just to resume, we're back at the quarry, and the next few shots are just people that have gone there with me. Notice this one includes a couple of children. This includes a couple of guests. This includes a couple of guests, spouses and such. This includes a couple of guests. Here's some more kids. This is summer of 2014. And well, there's a lot of important things here. One is that, just to kind of remind you, that many, many people have visited these sites. And they've seen the data for themselves. And they've included a lot of kids. And I wanted to jog back to the notion of the fact that God's creation is out there to be enjoyed. Is it? Are they here to find ammunition for a culture war? Are they here to enjoy God's good creation? So you'll see other slides that look like this throughout the talk, where I'll quiz you. You know, these folks are A, having a boring day of wasted time. No. I'll tell you that. No. Answer is no. Or they're B, having a great day enjoying God's creation. There's a next point to be made here. Oops, wait a minute. Sorry. What about all this waste? So just to bring back to mind There's a claim out there by many noted atheists, and unfortunately, some of our younger brethren have bought into this claim that all this death represented here, you find a lot of dead things, they represent, if there is a God at all, that God must be wasteful. He's wasted a lot of living things here, and he's absolutely indifferent as to whether they die or live. And the question is, are these kids, once again, thinking to themselves, oh, you know, if there is a God, he's really wasteful and indifferent, and he could care less about these creatures? Or are they thinking to themselves, these are really wonderful. These are really cool. They indicate that the Creator must be somebody really, really wonderful, right? And I would submit to you that not only are they having a great day, but they're saying to themselves, God is really, really wonderful. That he's made all these wonderful creatures. So my perspective is that the creatures that we now see represented by dead skeletons had their day in the sun. They lived, they thrived, they enjoyed life to the extent that a coral can be said to enjoy life, which probably, there is probably a little bit of merit to that idea somewhere at some low level, just because you and I are a lot smarter than they are. At any rate, they praised God in their own way. And God enjoyed them and rejoiced in them in a way that only he can appreciate, but which he lets us slightly share in. We get tastes of all this, right? So these are not telling us something about how wasteful God is. They're telling us something about how God is very prolific. He's just spewing out beautiful life forms. Okay. Here's another lesson that can be learned from looking at these creatures. This is in the wall of that quarry, and this is the same coral as the Petoskey Stone coral. It's hexagonaria. And this is a colony. Now we're looking at not at a colony on the top or bottom. We're looking at it's been dissected for us by the people blasting the quarry. And the nice thing is this, they keep blasting, they keep peeling back layers, which is basically allowing us to do the anatomy. If one wanted to, they could do the anatomy of a coral reef. So here we have a head of coral, and it tapers down to a point where it began. The initial colonizers settled down, they budded out. They fanned out. Here's where the colony stops. It must have stopped growing. It died for some reason. But here we have a renewed growth there. We have a renewed growth there. And I think we've got a renewed growth here. So maybe there was a storm or a coral bleaching event or something like that that wiped this out temporarily. But then it reestablished itself. And yes, here's some debris in here. These are things that were knocked over and dumped in there. So yeah, there's evidence for storms. There's evidence for hurricanes, but there's also evidence for accumulated time through the course of this. So we have to say to ourselves, how much time did it take for this piece of coral to grow in place here? Was it weeks, months, years, maybe a few years for a head to grow like this? And this is only a few feet of the rock. We have 80 to 100 feet exposed in the wall of the quarry and a deeper level below that. And the rock layers go down below and below and below and below. And you have to think, how much time is all that represented by just the simple concatenation of biological events? This impressed the early field geologists 250 years ago, 200 years ago. They said to themselves, there's a lot of time. So there's our Petoskey Stone, a comparison. And for me, this is a big wow, because I started looking at these corals 40 years ago, roughly, and they just are astounding to think about, you know, these beautiful creatures that were once alive. And then what about the rest of the creatures there? Okay, you know about this one already. These are some others. This is a trilobite. Of course, there's no trilobites alive on the planet today. There haven't been since the Permian. The trilobites belong to an extinct subphylum of arthropods. So now we're not talking about order or class. We're talking about a subphylum. talking about a lot of creatures. This is a spiriferid brachiopod. There are no spiriferid brachiopods alive on the planet today. This is an order of brachiopods, hundreds of species named from the Paleozoic, and not one of them is alive today. More, these two corals here are in the order Tabulata. So this is Arcatosti stone, that's in the order Rugosa. We've already looked at that. Here's another group of extinct corals, the order Tabulata. And this is a group of extinct brachiopods. This is Atropida, Atropida vanish shepherd, the Devonian. There's a reconstruction of this beautiful ancient coral reef community. What about the predators moving through them? Okay, the large fish here is an example of a placoderm. It's a carnivorous subgroup called arthrodires. So some of the placoderms were bottom-dwelling mud suckers. Some of them were active carnivores. This is a thing that got up to be 9-10 feet long and could easily eat me in two bites. Totally extinct. The placoderms don't appear after the Devonian period of geologic time. These are things that have been, these are Eurypterids. The state fossil of New York is a Eurypterid. They've been colloquially called sea scorpions. There are none alive today. Some of these, once again, were herbivores or mud grubbers. Some of them were carnivores. And they got up to 9, 10, 11 feet long, too. So we have the two major predators. This group is restricted to the Devonian strata, totally. This group appears in the Ordovician and extends through the Permian, so it's a little bit longer lived. In both cases, neither group is alive. Neither group has any representatives alive today. Totally extinct. So now we go back to this text. Here's the description that we were provided in the Answers in Genesis website. Okay. We'll look at this, but the next thing is the table. This is the actual data from Ehlers and Kesseling, Devonian strata of Alpena and Presque Isle counties, which was referenced in the article. And so this is the individual rock formation at Partridge Point. This is the larger cluster of formations called the Traverse Group. And here's the taxonomic groups and the number of genera. So remember, each genus probably represents several species. There's about 200 genera here. The next slide takes this exact same table and colors in red all the extinct groups. If you haven't gotten the point yet, everything's extinct. So all the stuff that the people there they're finding in Alpena, you would not find that same stuff if you were to go to Florida or the Bahamas today. Now, if you go back to the language, that article, he talked about corals, bryozoans, crinoids, etc., as though these were common sea creatures. In fact, all the genera are extinct. This is class Blastoidea extinct, class Cystoidea extinct, class Edrioasteroidea extinct, subphylum Graptolithina, subphylum Trilobita, two orders of corals. And within these groups here, these are clams, snails, and monoid-like creatures. The subgroups are all extinct, so this actually doesn't even show all the extinction. All the orders of bryozoans are extinct that are from down there. We have modern bryozoans in different orders. So what was being camouflaged there? This is the text now with the exact descriptions. Colonial corals, bunches of corals connected to one another like apartments. That's the order Rugosa and Tabulata, all extinct. Solitary corals is more order Rugosa, all extinct. Bryozoans, extinct orders of Bryozoa. Crinoid sea lilies, extinct orders of Crinoidea. The article actually admitted that stromatophoroids were extinct. Within the brachiopods, multiple extinct orders, Atropida, Stromatophoridae, Orthodens, Spiriferida, and Blastoids, relatives of the crinoids and sea urchins. All blastoids are long extinct. There are also fossilized remains of mobile sea creatures such as conodonts. No conodonts located in post-Triassic strata, all extinct. So what's not being said there is all the stuff in green
and most of the stuff in red. So the author has given the misapprehension that this is some sort of normal marine biota, like anybody would see if they went to the sea today, when in fact, it's completely different from anything our modern beachcomber would see, or a person on the shore of Florida. On the other hand, what's the flip side? So the flip side of that is what's not located in Alpena. Some things we've never located in Alpena include bony fishes. So yeah, there are placoderms there, but not modern bony fishes. These are things like tuna, bass, catfish, you name it, seahorses. 30,000 named species today in today's oceans and freshwaters. Not a single bone in Alpena. Diatoms, okay, these exist by the millions in the surface waters of Lake Michigan and the surface waters of the global ocean. There are probably the common phytoplankton of today's world. Not a single diatom located in those rocks in Alpena. Sand dollars? No. Okay. They have round sea urchins, but not irregular ones. These are our modern corals. These are the order Scleractinia. This is what a scuba diver or a snorkeler would see in the Bahamas. We do not have any Scleractinian corals in Alpena. We have rugosans and tadpoles. They're two extinct orders. The modern Scleractinian corals do not make their appearance until later on in the geologic column. There's no dinosaurs, of course, nor are there any mammals, nor any tetrapods at all. There's no marine mammals. That's kind of strange. If this was a conglomeration of things sloshing around in the water, why aren't we having eels? And also significantly, why are there no flowering plants? So in today's world, Ray can call me on this, maybe 800,000 species of named angiosperms?
250,000.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it's growing all the time, okay? And these include the grasses. They include all of our flowering plants, which include a lot of our trees, not our conifers. But these things also produce pollen. There's not a single grain of pollen in those Devonian strata. So there were no angiosperms living when that fossil bed formed. Okay, so we're talking about a completely different biota from today's biota, a completely different organic world. If we were transported back in a time machine, it would be wondrous. It would be incredible. And God got to see it all happen. But it would not be the same kinds of things that we would see today in Jamaica. Okay, you're going to see, I took time to explain this slide because you're going to see it about four or five times more, and you're going to get sick of it. There's a reason for doing that. It's called overkill. Just for fun, these are Jurassic age fossils from Germany. We don't find any crayfishes or lobsters at Alpena either. We have trilobites, but nothing like that. These are middle range bony fishes. This is a pterodactyl. We don't find anything with wings in Alpena. We don't find any bats. We don't find any birds. We don't even find any flying reptiles. So you'd figure these are produced by a catastrophic global flood tech device. Why didn't a single thing with wings actually get trapped in those floodwaters and buried in that too? Okay. We now expand them. So we were thinking about this. Now we expand it out. So every one of these gold stars are places where I've either collected fossils, taken students, including Sunday school groups, little kid groups, or walked around them. So once here, substantial collections from here, substantial collections from there. This is a state park in Iowa. It's an Army Corps of Engineers reservoir. Not allowed to collect there, which is a good thing. It's a public fossil bin ground. Here's an example, Hungry Hollow, Ontario. Hundreds to thousands of amateur rock hounds from Ontario converge on this place for months during the warm weather and pluck out fossils that look just like the ones you've already seen. Okay. This is a treasure here. This is Coralville Reservoir, Iowa. Anybody here from Iowa?
I visited it last summer.
You visited Coralville?
Yeah.
Isn't it wonderful?
It is fantastic.
It is incredible.
But once I have no eye for these things, but once you see what you're looking for, just you want to spend the rest of the month there.
Thanks. So in other words, you weren't having a wasted day of boring time. Nor was I. My wife and I went here. This, in 1990, this was not here. This was a campground. They had a flood over the spillway. It washed the campground away and exposed all these ledges of rock. They call it the Fossil Gorge. The gorge has at maximum 50 feet of relief from this level here to the bottom down there. So it's not quite a gorge, but it's pretty neat. And it was scoured clean again a second time in the early 2000s. Okay. This is what it looks like, and you start looking closer at the rocks, and what do you find? Little brachiopods, and there are familiar actors. This is a spiriferid brach, like the one we saw before. Group that's totally extinct. Atrophid brachiopods, corals, including my beloved Hexagonaria. Okay, there it is again. You know, and you know it's the same kind of creature to the thing I found in Missouri in the late 1970s or 1980. For me, once again, it's a big wow, okay? If you want to, I didn't include it on this map, but there's a state park in southern Indiana right on the shore of the Ohio River called Falls of the Ohio. You can go down there when the Ohio River is low, typically in the fall. You can walk across a vast Devonian coral reef. You're walking on the top of the reef. You may not collect there, just like a coral bill, but it's spectacular. So it turns out that around the world, you have large Devonian reef tracts in places like Australia, Western Canada, parts of Europe. The Devonian was actually the world's best time for coral reefs, but they weren't anything like our modern coral reefs in terms of the factors. Once again, these people are having a boring day of wasted time or having a great day enjoying God's creation. And I don't know these people. I took their picture and I hope they didn't see me because they're probably, they'd be wondering why that guy out there was photographing them. But I also threw this in just as a plug. Those little kids could very well have had this little book. How many people know this book? It's The Golden Guide to Fossils. It costs you $7. This thing has been in existence since, this says 2002, but it's like the 1960s. Oh, it doesn't say the original trademark. The author was a Christian, Frank Rhodes. He taught paleontology at the University of Michigan and then went on to become president of Cornell University in his tenure. And I don't know how many thousands of copies of this little golden guide have been sold, but these kids could have one of these and they could actually tell a few things to the person that wrote that block that put it out over the airwaves. And I actually recommend it. It's a wonderful little introduction to fossils. Okay, so once again, if you look out over the entirety of the Midwest now, what have we not collected? All these things from the modern aquatic world. Okay. What about below the Devonian layers? Once again, remember that if we want to go above or below the layers, all we have to do is travel laterally because the layers are warped. So in this case, we want to go to younger layers, so we'll go down to a place where they're warped up, which turns out to be, for my benefit, in southern Ohio and southern Indiana. There is a three-dimensional geologic structure down there named after Cincinnati called the Cincinnati Arch. We were here in the Devonian, and by traveling laterally to the southern part of Ohio or Indiana or northern Kentucky, we are traveling downwards to the Ordovician. Here's an example. So the colored map here is the outcrop belt of these Ordovician rocks. The different colors are for the different subunits. These are Calvin College students doing geologic exercises in southern Indiana, southern Ohio. I've taken them to northern Kentucky as well. In multiple places,
Here's an example from just last fall and a slab that we collected. These are very richly fossiliferous rocks. In fact, they're known throughout the world for their productivity. And all you have to do is find a new road cut down there, or a stream bed, or somewhere where someone's excavating a pond or whatever, and find fresh rock, and you'll find these rocks bleed fossils by the millions. What do we find there? This is a rugosan coral, solitary, different sea creatures. This is an extinct order of brachiopods, Strophomenida. An extinct order of bryozoans. This thing right here is called Constellaria because you can see little ornaments that look like stars. More trilobites. The trilobite here is the state fossil of Ohio. It gets up to 10, 12 inches long. We rarely find intact ones because these are delicate and they get disaggregated. We found lots of these little fragments. I found a cheek with an eye. That's one of the biggest trilobites that's ever existed. Up in Canada a few years ago, they found another species of Isatelus. I think, what did they call it? I forget. But it's this long. It's the biggest trilobite known. Biggest trilobite species known. This thing cannot, this family could not roll itself up. This one could. This is in the same general family as the trilobite we looked at from Michigan, but it's a different species, family Phacopodi. I kind of cried, but there are no living trilobites. Maybe one day we get to see one. Extinct brachiopods in the order Orthoda. This is an extinct echinoderm, an Edro asteroid. And we come back to this consistent point that these are not secrets. These things have been known for years and years and years. In this case, this is 80 years ago, and we have a rock hound group in southern Indiana collecting fossils from a railroad cut. Okay? So thousands of amateur rock hounds have collected these fossils. The knowledge here does not only belong to a special class of greedy scientists who want to hoard the knowledge in themselves and bend and twist it to their wills. But it resides in the collective knowledge of thousands of amateurs, including middle schoolers, grade schoolers, kids in rock hound groups, lots and lots of people. These are not secrets at all. Okay. Once again, what do we never find, despite the fact that there are thousands of these fossils in museum collections, in many, many institutions, and in private collections, right? We don't find any of these common creatures present from our modern day. Okay. What about above the Devonian layers? Once again, because the rocks are warped, in the state of Michigan, all I have to do is drive or walk to the center of the state, and I'm going up in the time scale. So I drive from Grand Rapids less than an hour to the east with students, and I have since 1992. And there's a group working in 2010, looking at the rocks and measuring them and making detailed notes. Here they are. This is an old abandoned clay mining pit for the manufacture of bricks and tile. We're looking at a shale here. That's what would have been used to make the bricks. And then a ledge of sandstone. If we go back for a minute, you can see here a little tiny piece of yellow sandstone. So this is envisioned as a quiet water lagoon with soft mud rocks forming. And then there's a little streamlet here. It's a distributary channel from a river, and it's carrying sand. And then that enlarges to form a big ledge of sandstone that's hard and resistant. And then above that, a layer of coal, telling us something about plants living on that site a long, long time ago. Isaac here, he's working hard as a student, but once again, he's having a great day. Okay. I think his smile says a lot. I love this picture. Okay. So here's the sand. And in that sand, we find plant roots. This is a plant root. This is about regular, actual size. It's about as thick through as my arm and about as long. This is growing laterally across the surface of the sand. We can find, in some cases, several of these things that converge on the center where the stump would have been. And then, well, pardon me, the kinds of plants that are indicated by these roots are, this is basically a tree-sized equivalent of a modern horsetail rush. So in the modern world, there's only about 30 surviving species. And they get to be about this tall. They're little thin things about the size of a pencil, very, very fragile. And this time, they grew as tall as trees. These are what nowadays would be club mosses, lycopods. And also, they form trees, whereas today, they usually are this tall, sometimes as bushes, but not very big. Once again, no flowering plants. That's strange. This is a plant community, but there are no flowering plants in it, nor are there any grains of pollen. But more to the point here, these long, slender things are carbonized root traces, and these are extending not across the top of the rock, but down into the rock. So these represent roots that were there in the sediment, in a swamp. They grew in place and died. And kind of like the coral that grew, that we kind of thought about the time, we have to kind of think about how much time did it take to form these ancient roots? Did it take days, weeks, maybe a few months, maybe even a few years to form a thick mat of roots that is about a meter or two deep off those trees that grew there? So here we have the evidence of an ancient forest that flourished, had its day in the sun, then died. An exciting, beautiful place, but unlike our modern forests. And there's the evidence that they actually formed there, and the evidence that it took time for them to form, all of that. What we don't find there are all these marine creatures that were so abundant up in the rocks in Alpena and elsewhere, nor do we find the modern creatures either. Okay. This I threw in for fun.
Wow.
This is the best part of the talk, right? It's the world's largest vehicle. This was a $100 billion vehicle built to saw rock. For scale, if you haven't noticed already, these are people. That's a truck. These are trucks. You can go online. If you go to like Google and Google the Bagger 288, you can see reconstructions of this thing as a transformer, one of these giants. You know, they reconfigure the arms, and you've got a big, vicious giant with its arms reaching out. You can actually do that, although they don't do that. But at any rate, the thing crawls around the surface of the ground and drills and digs. The point being here is that you don't spend $100 million on a vehicle if there's no geologic return for it, right? So here in northwestern Germany, the Germans have, up to this point, invested a lot of money in coal mining. They, unlike their French neighbors, who've chosen to generate most of their power by nuclear reactors, the Germans have done a lot with coal. I think they're downgrading that now. But at any rate, the coal seams there in Germany have the same kinds of plants as these coal seams that we see in Michigan.
So is that still functional?
That is very much still functional. That's right. And you can it will move from one quarry to the next over the span of several miles at a creeping rate. It will creep along. I think you could kind of collapse that so it's not so overbalanced. Yes?
Do you happen to know how many people it takes to make this operational?
I actually don't. I'm willing to bet it's not all that many. It's shocking how few people it takes to operate an ongoing quarry, a quarry in active operation once it's pretty mechanized. It's pretty shocking. Yeah. This is a postcard from that part of Germany just for fun. Greetings from Gelsenkirchen. And
These are, once again, the same kinds of plants that we would see here in Michigan or in Illinois. A lot of coal in Illinois, and it's the same plants. Okay. So now I've broadened it out to put elsewhere in red, and I've broadened it out to do Paleozoic era. So we've looked at Ordovician rocks, Devonian rocks, now Pennsylvanian rocks, and in all cases, we've not seen any of this stuff that would be familiar to a modern day sarcolith. I'm going to briefly jog to the Grand Canyon because that has been sort of a poster child for the Young Earth movement. This book was written in 1994, Grand Canyon Monument to Catastrophe, to explain how the layers of rock in the Grand Canyon were deposited in a single year-long flood, and then the canyon was eroded subsequently in the next few years into those soft rocks. There's a chapter here on fossils in this book, which uses the very same technique as the article that we already looked at, that the answers in Genesis lie. In other words, it explains that the fossils are sea creatures. They're corals, bryozoans, brachiopods. It doesn't tell people that they're all extinct. That's a great travesty in terms of information conveyance. Okay. You can go and participate in raft rides down the Grand Canyon where the raft guides will explain how it all formed in a short time. And they have a conception of how all these thousands of feet of rock formed in a single year-long flood and so forth. What about the fossils? So here we have in the lowest layers of not the inner gorge, but the regular stratigraphic sequence, a standard trilobite, like the ones we find around the rest of the world in Cambrian rocks, but not like what we see today, because there are no trilobites today. I've skipped a lot and jumped up to the topmost layer of the Grand Canyon, the Kaibab Formation. Here's a Productine brachiopod. Occasionally, they're found with their spines intact. They were had very delicate spines. The fossils are the same kinds of sea creatures that we expect to find in Pennsylvanian age marine rocks, Permian age marine rocks around the world. They're not telling us anything new. It's the same story. You have never found any of those in the Grand Canyon. Okay. So here we have an interpretation of the Grand Canyon with all these layers of rock, and they were formed presumably from some huge sloshing around just a few thousands of years ago. And sloshing happened in the span of a year, involving vast periods of time. I mean, vast amounts is what I'm going to say, vast amounts of sediment. And you have to wonder why the fossils weren't mingled more, right? So Grand Canyon is now a creationist icon. And yet, what are they not telling the general public? So, in response to that, a group of geologists, mostly Christians and a couple non-Christians, put together this book. So if you wanted to have a commercial for a book, Kriegel Publishers in Grand Rapids published this. It's cheap, it's like $20, $22, something like that. Full of beautiful colored pictures. These are 10 of the 11 authors, and they include Steve Mosier, who teaches here at Wheaton in the geology department. Greg Davidson is the head of the geology department at University of Mississippi. He's a Wheaton alum. I have a bit part in that book in that I wrote the chapter on fossils. But Carol Hill is a former National Parks geologist who teaches at the University of New Mexico. She's really the instigator of the whole project. She recruited these two people, and Steve and Greg and Tim, and they put together the book, and some of the rest of us had little bits and snippets in it. So I wrote the chapter on fossils, but you can see that fossils are very relevant to the whole misrepresentation of the Grand Canyon. This book, This book, the last chapter is actually a field guide for someone who wanted to take a hike through the Grand Canyon. It's elegantly illustrated
lots and lots of color photographs. It's gotten rave reviews in lots and lots of different venues. There is a blog, a Facebook blog on it. You can actually, if you want to find out more about this book, you can go to Monument to Nature Earth. You can see this was deliberately, we argued about the title for a year. And came up with this. This is a deliberate takeoff on that book that you saw earlier, which was the Grand Canyon Monument to Catastrophe. This is Grand Canyon Monument to Nature Earth. It's also for sale at the visitor center at the National Park, the Grand Canyon National Park. So we get comments all the time from people who bought it and profited from it. So
we don't get any alternate titles.
Pardon me?
What were the alternate titles?
We argued over whether we wanted to have this on the cover since it sounded a little bit provocative. I'm sorry, I just can't remember. I'm sorry. Yeah, I guess it's not important. But if you did want a, you know, a sort of one really fun volume that you wanted to give to a non-scientist friend or a pastor, and it would actually be attractive, or someone who was on their way to a field, to, maybe they're taking their family to the Grand Canyon. This is actually a nice volume. So an interesting bunch of people to work with. Okay, we're getting close to the end here now. I'm broadening out the discussion to talk about this notion of the succession of life through time, biotic succession. William Smith is credited with being the single guy that probably pointed this out. He was an orphan, self-taught canal engineer, no college experience. Grew up in the late 1700s. As a canal engineer, he actually was the right guy at the right time at the right place. England was experiencing its industrial revolution. They needed coal brought all over the country from one place to the next. So he had the providential blessing of being the guy to actually do a lot of the survey for these canal routes, which meant that he traveled across much of this part of England. He knew the regional geology in that part of the world like the back of his hand. Much of this was by walking, of course, or horseback riding. Okay. He created what's credited to be the world's first ever large-scale colored geologic map, the Geologic Map of England, 1815. This is one of his cross-sections, color-coded. In some cases, Smith's colors, very colors, are still conventionalized on geologic maps today. Like the color green for Cretaceous age rocks, you see that used all around the world. This is his chart of strata. And they also, what Smith realized, which was revolutionary, was that individual layers had certain fossils. And all, if you wanted to actually peg the layer, all you had to do was get into the ditch or the canal or look at the road cut and actually look at the fossils, and you knew which layer you were in. So the fossils actually were diagnostic of the layer by layer structure.
Wow.
So he published this table. Because he had no university education, he was ignored for a little bit of time, but gradually he was accepted. His work was taken across the English Channel to the Paris Basin, where Georges Cuvier was credited with being the father of vertebrate paleontology, and Alexandre Brongniart, a very competent French mineralogist, worked out the stratigraphy of the region around Paris. They discovered the same thing there. There were diagnostic fossils in certain layers. And
how did the young Earth reconcile that specific issue?
Let's, if you'll hold off for a minute, I'll go there. But in, many of them don't. So let's, that's where I'm going. A couple more slides. I threw one more early scientist in this picture thing, but I could have thrown dozens. Adam Sedgwick was an ordained Anglican minister. He was an evangelical. He's credited with being one of the best field geologists of his generation. In fact, Michael Roos, who's a historian of science, who's an agnostic, calls him the best field geologist of his generation. Sedgwick did a lot of the pioneering geologic studies out here in Wales. This is Western England and Wales, and also down here in Devonshire. And he helped name the rock system Devonian, the very system that we looked at here in Alpena, Michigan, and elsewhere. He coined that name for the province of Devonshire, England. And he coined the word Cambrian for an old Roman word for the province of Wales. And so he gave us those two rock names. And he also gave us the word Paleozoic in 1838. The words Mesozoic and Cenozoic were coined by William Smith's adopted nephew, who was an orphan himself, John Phillips, became a geology professor at Oxford. And the way it turns out is that almost all of the words for these geologic time periods that you see here were coined by Christians. Not all of them. Some were coined by deists. But most of them were coined by Christians. So at one point in time, Christians were at the forefront of all this motion, and we kind of have let ourselves drop by the wayside, which is kind of sad. So George McCready Price was Seventh-day Adventist. He wrote a lot of books in the early part of the 20th century, and he ridiculed this idea that there was an order of fossils in the rocks. His own, what he conceived of as his greatest product was this book, The New Geology, 1923. McCready Price actually, as it turned out, didn't actually care much about going to rocks and looking at them personally. He just merely repeated. He used a lot of other illustrations that he cribbed from other sources and so forth. Kind of a sad case. But he also bequeathed to Whitcomb and Morris the practice of vilifying people that you disagreed with. Mm. Now, in multiple places in his publications, McCready Price said, likened the activity of geologists to a modern-day card cataloger in a library. In other words, they sorted the rock layers into an arbitrary system that just fit what they wanted. In this case, the target is an alphabetical order of book titles, right? That's all that matters is the alphabetical order. So McCready Price said all that matters to the geologists is that they portray a linear system where you have increasing complexity of life forms, and they'll just shuffle the layers around, right? Ignores the fact that thousands upon thousands of professional geologists and just as many more, if not more, amateur rock hounds had seen the evidence in front of their face that the fossils occurred in a regular ascending order in rocks. Well, Whitcomb and Morris in 1961 took McCready Price up on that, and they also claimed that geologists were basically lying, and that they were indulging in circular reasoning, ordering the rocks to prove their thesis and so forth. Okay? Now we come back to this. So this is addressing your question here. This is utterly ignorant in terms of the acquaintanceship of the authors with real rocks. And I want to look at this one in particular. So I drug these off arbitrarily off three places on the web. This is from a young earth outfit in New Jersey. And the people that run their website are PhDs. So these are very smart people. One is a PhD in computer science. Another is a PhD in mathematics. They have other people that work with them that are very bright. They are undoubtedly very bright. Okay. I got to this point in my talk this afternoon, and Jeff Greenberg disagreed with me. For those of you that know Jeff, he said, they're not very bright. I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt. I say they're very, very bright. And there are lots and lots of other very, very, very bright people who have been tricked into thinking that geologists are utterly disconnected from empirical reality. They think that somehow or another geologists have all deceived themselves, and they indulge in this circular reasoning stuff, and so they propagate lies. Nothing can be further from the truth, and all it takes is a couple of years to actually get out and look at rocks and their entombed fossils, right? So there, you know, you can go and you can find lots of veterinarians, lots of engineers, people with PhDs in pharmacy, anatomists, people who basically are very, very good scientists that don't have to look at layered rocks or fossils.
And they very easily, evidently, swallow the stories that were begun by George McCready Price, continued by Whitcomb and Morris and the people coming after them. And the plain fact is that if you want to have a discussion or a disputation about the fossil record and whether it resulted from a year-long flood, this has to be abandoned. This is not a fruitful approach. And if you go to a professional geologist with this and say, this is what you do, he'll be scornful, utterly scornful of your approach. He'll say, you have no basis in reality, you know? If we get back to the Bagger 288 or whatever that machine was named, let's broaden it out and think about an oil drilling platform. Here you have a machine that you build at the cost of $1 billion, and you run at a cost of nearly $1 million a day, operating fees. And if you don't know anything about the layers of rock below the water in the Gulf of Mexico, where you're drilling, or off the shores of Alaska, where if you're drilling in the dark and don't know how to target those, you're going to go bankrupt in about a week or less. So there has to be some reality to this order of rocks, because people have been using it as a tool for exploration and extraction for a couple hundred years. So this is not fruitful, needs to be abandoned. I can pass up this slide again, ma'am. The last two slides are actually individuals who are young Earth creationists, flood geologists, who actually believe that the fossils occur in an order. So these represent people that actually can be talked with. Leonard Brand is a fine fellow. He teaches at Loma Linda University in California, Seventh-day Adventist institution. And Brand, like several other of his Seventh-day Adventist colleagues, understands well that fossils actually occur in a regularly repetitive order. And he's built a model of the flood that basically has a gentle flood, not a cosmic catastrophe, a gentle flood rising slowly and overwhelming ecosystem after ecosystem after ecosystem. I still don't think it works. I don't think his model works. But at least he's passed the facile criticism that geologists are indulging in circular reason. And Andrew Snelling has written a two-volume set that is supposedly the best thing since Whitcomb and Morris. They are the creme de la creme of creationist geology, and he's willing to accept that fossils occur in an order. So I think they're both wrong. I think they and a few others like them that are willing to work with the idea of an order to the fossils are utterly wrong because time is involved. But nonetheless, they're at least willing to get away from this claim of circular reasoning. So we come back to some of the goals for the talk. Elaborating on number two, what I've tried to show here is that fossils occur in intact, recognizable suites, what we call an ecological, a recognizable ecology. In the case of Alpena, you saw 200 genera in many diverse groups, all aquatic, all marine. The biotas occur, they do occur in a regular ascending order, and it doesn't matter whether you disagree with it, whether you dislike that idea or not, it's true, okay? They do occur in a regular ascending order. That's an issue to be addressed and not something to be dismissed as circular reasoning. Okay. Within any given suite, what we've seen here is evidences like the roots growths and so forth. There lie evidences for the passage of significant time. What a formal term for this in the discipline of stratigraphy is, these are called intrinsic timekeepers. In other words, inside the rock itself, there lies a little timekeeper, something that tells you about time. And so even if you don't want to think about radiometric dating techniques, if maybe that's just too arcane for you, you can do what the geologists 250 years ago did. They looked at these rocks and said, well, we've got thousands of feet of rock, and with any given few inches, we have evidences for time. Time, 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 time. That's a lot of time. And they knew by 1800 that the Earth had a lot of time.
and it's that one.
Back to the radioactive dating, is that consistent throughout the layers?
Yes. I'll qualify that in just a minute. I just want to come. I've got two more slides, so. Yeah. So here's the, maybe three. This was the intermediate claim here. Based on what we've seen, there is abundant evidence. It's been available it's been understood for a couple hundred years, and it's been seen by thousands of professional geologists, students, and amateur rock hunters for a long succession of life forms on Earth. The theological punchline for that, from my perspective, is that reveals that God is a patient and prolific creator. Now, anyone who's a Christian knows already that God is a patient creator, because I know God's been patient with me, right? We know from the Bible that it says the only reason why Jesus is not back right now is that he's patient. Thanks, Ray. You know, he's patient, not wanting anyone to perish, but for everyone to come to repentance. Right? And, I've made lots and lots of mistakes, and I've made lots of sins, and God has dealt with that. He's been very, very patient with me. The very fact that he's created people to be born as completely helpless babies and have to be raised by their parents through a protracted, childhood and be utterly helpless and dependent upon them tells you that he's designed some time and he's patient with all this process. That appears to be part of the way creation works. So I don't think this is a real surprise to people, Christians. The fact that he's prolific, this should, God loves living creatures. It's his plan for populating the earth, and he's evidently enjoyed all these life forms. And if anything, the little glimpses he's given us of these beautiful things actually ought to amplify our view of him being a pro-life creator. The fact that some people can downplay that and say, well, it indicates that he doesn't care, that's fast backwards. This is the last slide. So when I collected this beautiful slab, I was having a great day enjoying God's creation. Mm-hmm. That's it.
All right, well, we had a few questions threw up. If I could just have you wait for a couple more questions. I'll go ahead and set up the refreshment stuff there. We forgot to send donation box around, and $5 would certainly help us quite a bit. But certainly, it's up to you.
And if you wanted to look at the little golden eye of fossils, there are more official books.
So while that's going around, is there another question or two?
We had a question here about radiometric dating.
How about that? Yeah.
So. I've taken the time to study radiometric dating. It's not something that, to me, comes easily. And to undergraduate students, it's really, really important. But nonetheless, you have to study the decay equations were figured out by none other than Ernst Rutherford, the guy that discovered the atomic nucleus. So Ernst Rutherford won the Nobel Prize for physics or chemistry, I forget which off the top of my head. And his chemist, who was a fellow named, Soddy, S-O-D-D-Y. His chemist Soddy actually won the Nobel Prize later on as well. So these people were not dumb. They actually discovered that the actual phenomenon, how radioactive decay works, and the fact that it is an exponential product, and they came up with the first radioactive decay equations. Once you understand the basic decay equations, and it only takes a sophomore physics education to understand that, so it takes integral calculus, but once you can understand the mathematics of a line that looks like that, you can understand radioactive decay. And then once knowing that,
all you need to know, well, you need to know a few things. You need to know that for every individual radioactive isotope, the only thing that varies, the line stays the same, but the scaling is different because the rate of decay is different. So you can measure the rate of decay, you can work out an equation. And then Rutherford actually dated rocks, 1905. Mm. So he reasoned back that you have X amount of something at the start, and you have less than that at the end, but you also have a daughter product. If you can find out how much daughter and add the parent together, collectively they represent what you had to start with. The trick is being able to measure accurately the daughter product and the parent product, and also to know from really, really good geologic reasoning and chemical reasoning whether there was any daughter product to start with or not. So a classic case, the easiest case really, is potassium argon, right? You start off with a molten mass of rock, absolutely molten, and if there were argon in that rock, it would have fizzed off in that molten rock. So there was no daughter product to start with. There was potassium. Some of that potassium was radioactive. That radioactive potassium 40 decays actually by two different decay routes through time. One is useless for our purposes. I can talk about that in a minute. The other one goes to argon 40. And so at the end, you've got leftover potassium 40 that isn't gone yet. And you've got argon 40, and you measure argon 40, you measure the ratio between the two, and you work your decay rate back, and bingo, it comes out. Now there are complications, right? So what happens if the rock is heated along the way? It releases the daughter product, you get a spuriously young date. The opposite can happen, and this is something that young Earth geologists have exploited. They've exploited people's ignorance on this. Let's suppose that you're on the island of Hawaii, and you have a layer of basalt lava. That basalt has cooled, it has a radiometric date. And then let's suppose that another layer of basalt comes up through that, okay? The layer of liquid coming up through the rock that's already been extruded will actually incorporate some of that rock, and it will trap some of the daughter argon formed time A. So maybe we should draw it on the board. Would that be useful?
I think you got a pretty good explanation.
Okay.
If you wanted to go ahead and
layer A, which happened at time A, an injection of lava comes up. You have layer B, which is younger than layer A, and yet layer B has incorporated some of the argon from the first layer. Okay. Now all of a sudden, that's got old argon in it. So if you go out and grab a bunch of that rock and measure the date, it looks like it's maybe a couple thousand years old, and yet you know it formed yesterday. So that sort of thing has been the common attack mode by a lot of young Earth proponents. And basically, the geochemist, the trained geochemist whose responsibility it is for quality control, knows, okay, there's a suspect here. I'm not going to take this at face value. I've got reasons, good chemical reasons to suspect this date. The younger geologist says, well, okay, you just threw out the date you didn't like, right? And so there are example after example after example like that. The geochemist is doing quality control, and they're not accepting certain situations. And that's claimed as basically, well, you're only accepting the date you want. But if you ignore those, and those are a small subset of the dates, if you just look at the broad categories of dates, they concur with all of this pretty well. And by using different methods too, so you can use different techniques like rubidium strontium, neodymium samarium, different systems that that have different decay paths and so forth, different, actually, you know, the scaling of the equation is different, and you get the same answers. So it's a craft, you know, just like any other science, and you have to do it right.
Okay, we can continue these conversations around the table with refreshments. Thanks again, Ralph.
Yeah, sure.